Our speaker, Professor Robert Newman, will offer us a critique of Carl Sagan's Cosmos, his television series, as well as his book.
Killed up like that, the rest of this talk is bound to be downhill. Well, tonight we want to look at Carl Sagan's Cosmos TV series and his book, which is a somewhat more detailed treatment of the same materials. Just for my own interest's sake, I'd like to ask a little audience participation right here. How many of you have either seen the TV series, let's say in whole or part, or have read the book in whole or part? Could I see some hands for that? Okay, we've got a number of people here that have had some contact with it then. Let me say in preliminaries that Carl Sagan's Cosmos series and book have many very good features to it. I think it's a very well-written book, very well-presented series. Sagan himself is an excellent communicator. The book is beautifully illustrated. I've not seen the series, but what I've heard about it sounds like it's quite good as well. There's a great deal of valuable scientific information in the book, and I think we get a good picture in the material of Sagan's own enjoyment of science, his love for the universe and the study of it. I think we see a great deal of that here. I think we also see a concern of Sagan that an anti-intellectualism has been developing in recent years, and he is concerned to try and turn that around. He's concerned to see a departure from science, which he feels will be disastrous in various ways. And I'm inclined to agree with him in that particular area. However, most of what I'm going to be saying about Cosmos this evening is going to be rather of a negative sort, because I feel that Sagan has made a number of errors that are, in fact, quite serious. The first of these, I suppose, is related to the whole question of just what is the Cosmos series, just what is the book Cosmos. Back in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, a very popular pastime in many people was reading sermons, whole books of sermons published in that period. You find fairly hard to find people who enjoy reading sermons these days, but that was something that was quite of interest at that time. Even today, in the mass television media, there are a lot of people who watch TV preachers, watch TV evangelists. Think of Billy Graham, Jerry Falwell, various others. Well, Carl Sagan is a TV evangelist. His book is a collection of sermons. This thought perhaps has never occurred to you before, but I think that's probably because you have not identified Carl Sagan's religion. Carl Sagan is an evangelist for what we might call secular humanism, a belief that this universe is all there is, that man is the highest thing in evolution in our part of the universe anyway. Of course, we might be able to find something higher if we went a few stellar systems away from here, but basically that, I think, is a fair evaluation of what is going on here. We might even say that his book of sermons and his evangelistic messages open with a text, just as sermons in the 17th, 18th, and 19th century regularly began with a text. Carl Sagan's text is, "The cosmos is all that is, or ever was, or ever will be." Now, by Sagan's own definition of the methodology of science, that is not a scientific statement. That's a religious statement. For instance, we're not saying, by the way, get ahead of myself here, we're not saying, by the way, that that statement might not be true. I don't think it is. What I'm saying is that is not scientific in the sense that it's methodologically not a scientific statement. How's that? To say that the universe is all that is must mean methodologically that you have looked at all that is and found it's all cosmos. Unless you want to reduce his statement to merely a definition. I am hereby defining the cosmos as all that is. I'm rather sure that Sagan is not doing that in that particular statement. For if we say the universe is all that is, we face three barriers that I can think of, epistemological barriers, with regard to the possibility of saying that, not to mention the rather non-trivial barrier that man's mind is limited in extent, and he cannot hold in it all the information that is. These three barriers are this. There's a macroscopic barrier to being able to say that the cosmos is all it is. How's that? We can look out into space with large telescopes, and we can see objects that might be 10 billion light years away, the most distant quasars. The exact distance of those is disputed at the present time, particularly due to problems with getting the distance measurements worked out exactly right. But we do not know what lies beyond those distances. Those are the objects we can see furthest away, with the exception, perhaps, of the cosmic black-body radiation, which one could argue comes from a further distance than that. We have also a microscopic barrier. When we look down at the smallest size scales we can consider, we find that we begin to run into a barrier related to the uncertainty principle. And that barrier basically functions in this way, that if you want to look at something very small, you have to use a form of light, we'll say, a form of wave, a wave particle, get too tangled up here, that has a very small wavelength. And the smaller the wavelength, the smaller the size you want to look at, the smaller the wavelength you have to use. But the smaller wavelengths have the larger energy. And because quantum theory says that energy cannot exist in anything but packets of finite size, where the wavelength and the energy are related by a fixed constant, the smaller the wavelength, the larger the energy gets. You eventually get to a point where the energy you are using to look at things disrupts those very things, and you are no longer able to observe them as they are. You are only able to observe them in a disrupted condition. The result is that although things are going on below the epistemological barrier that we can examine, when we try to examine them, we disrupt what was there, and we do not know what the causality involved is. So, in arguing that the cosmos is all that is, you have a macroscopic barrier, you have a microscopic barrier, and it appears you also have a geometrical barrier. I'm thinking here in terms of Einstein's general theory of relativity, which suggests that in the presence of gravitating objects, the space becomes non-Euclidean, it is bent, and the bending is greater in respect to the larger amount of mass in a smaller volume, or greater the larger the density is in a given area. The idea of bending space itself, bending a three-dimensional space, rather suggests, on analogy with the idea of bending two-dimensional space, here, for instance, is a two-dimensional space in the sheet, and when I bend it in a third direction, a third dimension. The idea, then, of bending a three-dimensional space rather suggests the existence of a fourth spatial dimension. And if indeed that be so, then there is a whole realm which we have no way to even look at that exists. And I don't know whether you want to call it the cosmos or not, but it's not obvious that it's what we mean by the cosmos when we investigate and we don't know what's in it. How can one then say the cosmos is all that is on the basis of any scientific methodology? That should be sufficient, I think, to show that the statement is a faith statement, a philosophical statement, a religious statement, if you like, rather than a statement based on strict scientific methodology. The same sort of thing could be said about the statement the cosmos is all that ever was, for here you run into another epistemological barrier. We can trace things back of perhaps 10, 15, 20 billion years until we are stopped by some event which we call the Big Bang. Even those who believe that the Big Bang is not the beginning of all things, but only the beginning of this previous cycle of the universe, hold that in fact you cannot get behind the Big Bang, and therefore epistemologically you do not know what existed back in that previous period. So it would be rather difficult to say that the cosmos is all that ever was. To go on and say that the cosmos is all that ever will be involves the whole matter of predicting. And certainly if we know one thing today, I think we would have to feel that in order to predict, it is very difficult to predict the future without knowing all the data. If you don't know all the data to put in your computer, how then can you expect to be able to run some kind of a time extrapolation and be able to tell what it is that lies ahead? Suppose, however, we did know all the data necessary. We would have to build a computer about the size of the universe, perhaps somewhat larger, to store all this data. It would have to operate at maximum speed, perhaps sending signals at the speed of light back and forth between its various memory units and operating sections. And even at that rate, it would only be able to predict about the same speed as time is actually progressing. So you would be doing nothing but building perhaps a parallel universe and seeing whether it stayed aligned with the one you're looking at. So we have some rather serious problems with this whole area of predicting the future, of saying the universe is all that ever will be. The most serious of these, however, is the statement, the universe, the cosmos is all that is. Now, in dealing with the whole question of what sort of work Sagan's cosmos is, we need to take a brief look at his attitude towards competing religions. Sagan rather clearly sees a threat in the growing mysticism around today. I think he is worried that science might die out in competition with mysticism, as it appears to have happened in the Greco-Roman civilization. As Sagan himself points out, the golden age of science in the ancient Greek civilization was over by the time you reach the first century AD. The large number of scientists he has on his chart are gone by the time you reach even the first century AD. And I think Sagan is concerned that something of that sort might indeed happen. I'm concerned myself that science might indeed die out. It is possible it could. It has happened before. It happened in the Greco-Roman civilization. It happened in the Islamic civilization. And it might indeed happen again. I'm not sure whether Sagan has properly analyzed why it might die out, but I think he is right that a competition with some kind of mysticism would be involved there. Most of Sagan's fire is reserved for Christianity, which he apparently sees as a threat to science. I'm not too sure why he sees this to be so, since modern science arose in Christianity, and not obvious then why it would necessarily try to put it to death. Christianity is perhaps in some ways less hostile to science now than it has been for centuries, but we will look at that in a moment. It is possible that Sagan's fire is reserved for Christianity because he has an eye on the creation-evolution controversy, which has begun to stir again in recent years. I'm not sure. In any case, it is fair to say that one theme of Sagan's treatment is Christianity seen as the foe of science. Christianity seen as a foe of science. He has a number of examples in this direction, and those examples, it seems to me, are somewhat apologetic, somewhat evangelistic in their nature, rather than being a fair and balanced discussion of the relationship of Christianity and science over their history. He brings up the story of Hypatia and the Alexandrian Library on pages 335 and 336. I believe that's in his last or next to last of his 13-part series. And this story, indeed, is an example of the terrible things that have been done in the name of Christianity. There have been terrible things done in the name of Christianity. This particular one, if you're not familiar with it, involves a woman scientist, probably the greatest woman scientist of antiquity, named Hypatia, was an attractive person, person with many students, studied in Alexandria, a Neoplatonist, and she was put to death by a mob of persons calling themselves Christians, doubtless who thought they were Christians, maybe many of them were Christians, I do not know, I use a definition of Christian that the Bible gives, not that everyone who calls themselves Christians are Christians, was a rather terrible thing that was done there. They apparently believed that she was influencing the Roman governor of the province against the Christians, and she was mobbed when she was riding through the streets, stripped, killed, apparently flayed with oyster shells. I certainly wouldn't condone any activity of that variety. And yet, we do need to realize for balance that terrible things have been done in the name of science as well. Hitler slaughtered 6 million Jews in the Second World War was allegedly a scientific activity to improve the genetic stock. Now, a lot of scientists would not accept that, but Hitler had a lot of scientists who accepted that. That was done in the name of science. And I think a scientist would not accept that as really being scientific at all. Well, I think a Christian who believes what the Bible teaches about ethics would not accept what was done to Hypatia as being Christian at all. Sagan's version, however, of this Hypatia story does contain several errors, which, when these are corrected, rather greatly weaken the value of the story as a picture of the conflict of science with religion. First place, the action itself was deplored by many Christians at the time it occurred. And one of these persons wrote in his church history the incident about the thing, which is the only historical information we have that occurred. All the information we've got about the event was written in a Christian source, Socrates' church history, not the Socrates of Greek philosophy. One prominent Christian leader, Synesius, bishop of Ptolemais, had been a student and an ardent admirer of Hypatia. We have a number of his letters still extant today. The Christians did not, at the time, treat this as a good thing. Secondly, the action itself was not a Christianity versus science action. It was a church versus state struggle. The governor of the province of Egypt, Orestes, was beginning to take action against the Christians, and the bishop of Alexandria tried to oppose him, spoke rather strongly against him, and I think it's fair to say that Cyril, bishop of Alexandria, did have some responsibility for what happened, whether he intentionally was involved in organizing or not. At least some of the things he said led some of his followers to carry out this particular activity. But it was a situation in which, if you like, a scientist got caught in the middle of a controversy that was not in itself a Christianity-science struggle. In Sagan's work, there is a picture as though the destruction of the Alexandrian library was the outcome of this putting to death of Hypatia. There seems to be a rather serious chronological error here. The historical information I can find indicates that the vast majority of the Alexandrian library was destroyed something like 150 years before Hypatia's time, in 273 AD. The event of her death is in 415. Most of the library had been destroyed in 273 when a civil war during the time of the Emperor Aurelian took place, and that whole section of the city was burnt down. The rest of the library, the Serapeum, which is in fact the library that you see the reconstructions of in the TV program, that you see the pictures of in the book Cosmos, was, as far as we can tell, closed by the Emperor Theodosius I in 391 AD, which would have been about 25 years before the Hypatia incident. It's difficult to see where he gets his statement that Hypatia's work was destroyed in the Alexandrian library, that the Christians hating science had burnt down the library, and things of that variety. So I think there is some example there of a desire, if you like, to present Christianity as the foe of science, and yet the historical details, the particular example it gives, are not very good ones. Sagan also mentions Luther's rejection of the Copernican theory on page 53 of his work, and that is a correct statement. Luther spoke some fairly strong words against Copernicus when he heard of the Copernican theory. We should, however, balance that with a little fairness by pointing out that Luther heard of Copernicus' theory no earlier than when it was published. And it was published in 1543, just 3 years before Luther himself died. So Luther was very near the end of his life. Luther was not a scientist. He was a theologian. And he heard that this fellow had an idea which was going to change our whole view of the world. It was going to take the Earth, which everybody knew was in the middle, and put the Sun in the middle, and move the Earth, which everybody knew stood still, have it swishing around the Sun. Now, it's easy for us, looking back from several centuries, to say, boy, Luther was sure a dope. Why didn't he believe this fellow Copernicus, who was right after all? Well, it's very easy for us when talking over the football games on Monday morning. We will never fumble. We'll always have the right play, you know. But we weren't there when the plays were going on. Actually, Copernicus' theory did not fit the data better than the Ptolemaic theory until Kepler introduced the idea of elliptical rather than circular orbits, which was after 1601, over 50 years after the appearance of the Copernican theory and the death of Luther. It would be no more fair to take this as an example of Christian opposition to science than it would be to take the reaction of the geologists when Wegener first suggested that the continents moved around and blast them because 3 years after he proposed it, they didn't agree with him. It took years to get enough data to show that some kind of continental movement actually explained the phenomena of global geography better than land bridges and things of that variety. Now, Sagan does mention Galileo's run-in with the Catholic Church, page 142, and that is a collision between science and Christianity, if you like, although it's probably fair to say it's a collision of old science with new science. That happens all the time. The views that Galileo was colliding with, again a Ptolemaic theory, had been around for a long time. An earlier form of it had been used by Aristotle. Aristotle had become known again during the High Middle Ages. The Christian Church had sat down and tried to synthesize their views of the Bible with Aristotle's view of science, and they had worked out a nice synthesis. It took a couple hundred years to do it. Theologians weren't totally enthusiastic about suddenly tearing down this whole thing they had built up just because some fellow told them that indeed the Earth went around the Sun rather than vice versa. Actually, what we have then is a situation in which you have an old scientific view that had been well accepted for a long time being challenged by a new scientific view. At Galileo's time, Kepler was just working out the elliptical orbits that begin to make the data fit a little bit better. And so we see some conflict going on there. Now, even in scientific revolutions, it's often the case that the guys holding the old views don't change their views. They just get old and retire and die. And it's the new guys coming in, getting trained, that have the new views. And that's often how a position in science changes. Although the ideal of science is sort of everybody is to be 100% objective and ready to jump whenever the data changes, that ideal is not reached. Just in science, you also have the same problem, that people like their views because they published on it, because they're famous for it. They don't want to change. Well, you have the same kind of problems in Christianity too. Christians are people, scientists are people. Somewhat disappointing in a survey of the relationship between science and Christianity that Sagan does not mention the role of Christianity in the origin of modern science. Men who have worked in the area feel there's good evidence that there were a number of features of Christianity that are responsible for the origin of modern science. Sagan had an excellent opportunity to bring that in when he was discussing a problem with Greek science. Greek science never got very far in many directions because the Greek upper class, the ones who had time to do any science, despised manual labor. And therefore, there was never the fruitful marriage, if you like, between science and technology that occurred in connection with the origin of modern science. The difference there is that in Greek thought, manual labor was a thing to be looked down upon. In Christian thought, manual labor is a good thing. It's something we are commanded to do, although it has become a toilsome thing since man has fallen into sin. And a person who is a laborer is not to be looked down upon, but one who is to be accepted as accomplishing as much, as being as important in society as one who is a thinker. If you would like to see some balancing material in this whole area of the origin of modern science to go with Carl Sagan's Cosmos, I would suggest Herbert Butterfield, The Origins of Modern Science, R. Quicus, Religion and the Rise of Modern Science. And there's even a rather interesting chapter in Beryl Smalley's work, The Study of the Bible in the Middle Ages. Sagan also, showing, I think, a lack of balance, does not discuss various bad episodes that have occurred in the history of science. You know, when the science has looked bad, it does not discuss, for instance, the fact that the French Academy was unwilling to believe in meteorites because only peasants and priests had reported finding them, and they didn't trust either. Thomas Jefferson, one of the great lights of science and of rationalism in the United States, said when he heard that professors in northeastern universities had discovered and reported on meteorites, he said, "I would rather believe that Yankee professors can lie than that stones can fall from the sky." We also have the problem of Haeckel's falsification of embryo drawings in attempting to put forward the idea of recapitulation at an early time. You have doubtless heard more than you want to hear about the Piltdown hoax, and hoaxes can occur in any group. Hoaxes themselves are not bad things. What is a little distressing about the Piltdown hoax, I think, is the large number of theses and conclusions about the culture of Piltdown Man that were based on what, after all, turns out to be a hoax. A recent one, lest anyone think that bad things in science have stopped happening, is the popular book The Jupiter Effect by Gribben and Plageman. A book that frankly builds a whole case on a false statement that the planets will be aligned in 1982, whereas any calculation would not have taken too much time to do, would show that the planets don't even lie within a 90-degree angle. They are all on the same side of the sun, but they are scarcely anything like lined up. There have also begun to turn up some very disturbing examples of data falsification in scientific circles. These are things to be deplored. But it's certainly not a fair treatment of the history of the relationship of Christianity and science to emphasize where Christians, professing Christians in the case, have fallen down, and then ignore the fact that scientists have done the same thing. I think this whole picture of Christianity versus science is a simplistic picture. There is no question that Christianity is opposed to secular humanism. They hold inconsistent philosophical or theological views. The one holds that there is no God and that religious views are detrimental. The other one holds that there is indeed a God, but agrees with secular humanism that wrong religious views are detrimental. There are plenty of Christians who are scientists. There is, however, a tension between at least conservative Christianity and science today. But you ought to at least give the conservative Christians a break in this point. They believe that science in the area of evolution has taken a wrong turn, and that that influence has had a huge influence on our society, and it's a detrimental influence. If they're right that it's taken a wrong turn, they are certainly not doing anything harmful in opposing those views. If they're wrong, of course they're doing something harmful in opposing those views. The question comes down not to so much motivation and such, But who is right? I was a little puzzled when I noticed last night that there was no mention at all of Islamic science in this particular work of the cosmos, a flourishing activity in the early Middle Ages, which apparently was quashed during the late Middle Ages. Would certainly have been a great illustration to bring in of the problem of religion and its interference with science. Then I noticed something rather interesting. The Cosmos series was sponsored by Atlantic Richfield Refining Company. I wondered whether or not that might not be involved. I don't know. Let's move on to more substantial questions. Where did the universe come from? Sagan here deals rather briefly with the possibility that God might have had something to do with it. Page 257. If the general picture of an expanding universe and a Big Bang is correct, we must then confront still more difficult questions. What were the conditions like at the time of the Big Bang? What happened before that? Was there a tiny universe devoid of all matter, and then the matter suddenly created from nothing? How does that happen? In many cultures, it's customary to answer that God created the universe out of nothing. But this is mere temporizing. If we wish courageously to pursue the question, we must, of course, ask next where God comes from. And if we decide this to be unanswerable, why not save a step and decide that the origin of the universe is an unanswerable question? Or if we say that God has already always existed, why not save a step and conclude that the universe has always existed? What Sagan is doing here is an application of Occam's razor. Occam's razor is a late medieval principle which basically says it's vain to do with more what can be done with fewer. One should not multiply entities beyond necessity, or perhaps as we would modify it in science, one should keep his hypotheses as simple as possible, consistent with the data. The catch, of course, is consistent with the data. Is the view the universe has always existed as a better explanation than that God has always existed, one that is actually favored by the data? Sagan, as we see looking through his book, believes in what we call an oscillating Big Bang theory. Oscillating Big Bang theory, presented sloppily, is that at the present time, the universe is expanding. That means at least that the galaxies are moving apart from one another, and probably that the whole space manifold is expanding. And he believes that the density of matter in the universe is high enough that relative to the speed at which it's expanding, the universe will continually slow down in its expansion until it eventually reaches a point where it is no longer expanding. And then it will begin to collapse. And it will collapse faster and faster until a very, very high density is reached, and then the universe will bounce. And that will be a new Big Bang starting the next expansion. That basically is Sagan's view of the oscillating Big Bang theory. This view faces two problems, either of which would be fatal to the view unless they can be solved. One of them is, however, a minor problem observationally, and the other one, I think, somewhat more of a major problem, and it is a theoretical and observational problem. The minor problem, is there enough matter, that is there enough matter density in the universe to stop the expansion of the universe? Well, we can look into space and we can count the visible objects, stars, galaxies, things of that variety. And we can estimate from the way galaxies rotate what invisible matter is in the neighborhood of those galaxies. We can also look into space at the quasars and try and see if we can detect invisible matter between us and them that would, hydrogen is basically what we're after, that would in some way make absorption lines in the spectrum of the light from the quasars. With these things carried out, it looks like we are short a factor of 10 to 100 of having enough matter density to stop the expanding universe expanding and make it begin to collapse. That would suggest then that if we don't find some more matter, I'm not talking about some more matter out there somewhere, but a larger matter density, then the universe is going to keep expanding forever, and it must presumably then have had only one bounce, and that 15 to 20 billion years ago. At the moment, the only way out that anyone has suggested is that neutrinos might, after all, have mass, and that maybe the mass of these would be large enough to bail the problem out. I think we can say we don't know for sure whether that will work out or not. It is possible that neutrino mass might be large enough to stop the universe from expanding and to start it collapsing. The major problem, I think, is at the other end of the scheme, the bounce itself. In Sagan's view, the Big Bang is actually a big bounce. The universe was contracting before that time. At that point, it stopped contracting and began to expand. Present time, we do not know of any force that would stop a contracting universe from contracting and to start it expanding again. It appears that when you get enough mass together, it will not only overcome minor forces, such as electromagnetic and weak interaction, it will also overcome the strong interaction, and the material will pull into a black hole. This appears to be the case for even a star, something like 5 or 10 times the mass of the Sun, as it begins its final collapse. Here we're thinking in terms of the whole universe's matter being gotten into a relatively small volume, very high densities, and the question then of whether there is a force to stop that. So basically what Sagan has to do is postulate a large unknown force that will do just the right thing. It will not come into play until the density is high enough to have the radiation that we associate with the Big Bang, and yet it will be strong enough to stop that contraction and start an expansion. That at least is a problem. One has to postulate a large unknown force to solve the problem. Robert Jastrow, who is a professor at Hiss, Dartmouth, Columbia, but also a director of the Goddard Institute of Space Studies in New York City, believes that there is another serious problem with that, which he thinks is pretty insuperable, and that is that a large force would have an associated large energy, that the equivalence of mass and energy, which Einstein's principles hold, E equals mc squared, would then mean that when this force begins to come into play, you have a large additional equivalent mass. That large additional equivalent mass gravitates as well, and so adding a large repulsive force basically increases your gravitational force enough to overcome it. He gives a very quick treatment of that in his book, Until the Sun Dies, on page 29. I have not seen calculations on that, so I do not know whether he is right in that particular point. But, as we summarize these things, where did the universe come from? Sagan believes the universe has always existed in some form or another, and yet to maintain this view, he must suppose that somewhere between 10 and 100 times the known density of matter energy exists, and that there's also a powerful unknown force which violates mass-energy equivalence. Christians, on the other hand, suggest that these sort of things are an indication that the cosmos is not all that is, that the cosmos was brought into existence at a finite time in the past, one would guess at the time of the Big Bang. There's a second question that should be dealt with here that is also crucial to Sagan's position, and that is a question, where did life come from? Sagan is well aware of the complexity of life, and mankind, I think, has only become rather aware of that in recent years. Sagan wrote the article Life that appears in the last couple editions of the Encyclopedia Britannica. There he points out that the simplest living cell is a very, very complicated thing. And if we tried to represent the information content of the simplest living cell in terms of storage in a computer, the information content of the simplest living cell would be about 10 to the 12th power bits. If we converted this into information and wrote it out in large volumes, it would take up the space of 4,000 sets in Encyclopedia Britannica. Now the question is, where did this high level of organized complexity come from? Sagan's answer basically is time and chance operating within the realm of natural laws has produced from a very low level of complexity a very high level of organized complexity. Not many people, I think, have thought over the problem of generating any level of complexity by random processes. I've heard the statement made, give enough monkeys enough time, and then they'll eventually type out the Encyclopedia Britannica. And I think the response to that is, how many monkeys? How much time? I did a little calculation. Let's type out the title, Encyclopedia Britannica. To give the monkeys a break, let's have them type it on typewriters where they do not have to use a capital key. All caps on the typewriter. 33 keys, the 26 letters of the alphabet, period, space, a couple other form, punctuation forms. Let's imagine that that the monkeys are trained to be able to type constantly at 3 characters per second. Let us ask ourselves the question, how long would it take the monkeys to type a number of combinations equal to the number of possible combinations as long as Encyclopedia Britannica, that is, as long as those two words with a space between them? That turns out to be an enormously larger job than you would imagine. If we think of dividing the job up into something like man hours, you know, we'd say, how long is it going to take to paint this room? Well, you might say, 15 man hours, which would mean one guy could do it in 15 hours or 15 men could do it in an hour. Well, I worked out a calculation on this. You can do it over to yourself again if you'd like. Rounded a few things. I got 3 times 10 to the 28th monkey years is necessary to do this to cover those possibilities. That is 30 billion, billion, billion monkey years for those of you who don't use the exponential notation. Now, we've had 20 billion years since the last Big Bang. How many monkeys do you need to do the job in that length of time? 10 to the 18th. A billion, billion monkeys typing constantly on monkey-proof typewriters at 3 characters per second to just run through the various possibilities. That's not a practical calculation relative to the origin of life. You understand that. That's only an illustration to show the complication of producing even that level of order by a random process. Let's try a more practical calculation. The simplest protein occurring in life, I'm told, I've never seen a protein, never studied them very carefully, the simplest living protein occurring in life is a chain of about 100 amino acids. And there are about 20 different amino acids occurring in living things. So your problem is basically typing, if you like, a 100-letter word with a 20-letter keyboard. But we're not going to have monkeys doing it, because monkeys don't move amino acids around. Well, yeah, they move their own. Okay. All right. What we're going to do here is we're going to try and make several simplifying but favorable assumptions and see how long it would take to run all the possible 100-link amino acid chains. 20 possibilities per position. How long would it take? Well, here's the assumptions I've made. Let's assume that only 100-link chains are formed. So we're not going to waste any of the matter in the universe on forming 50-link chains and 125-link chains. We're only going to form 100-link chains. Okay? Let's assume that every nitrogen atom in the sample we use is in an amino acid. So we're not going to waste any of the nitrogens being in anything but amino acids. All right? Let's assume that the stuff is at a nice temperature, like 300 degrees Kelvin. Get it too much faster than that, it will begin to break things down. Assume they're a nice temperature like 300 degrees Kelvin, so whatever speed things move around at 300 degrees Kelvin, that's what we use. And let's assume they never repeat a combination, and they change combinations as fast as an amino acid can move the 10 angstroms, let's say, from one chain to another. Those are some very, very favorable simplifying assumptions. How long would it take to form all the combinations, 100-link chains, if we used all the matter in the solar system? About 5 times 10 to the 61st years. How long would it take if we used all the matter in the galaxy? about 5 times 10 to the 50th years. How long would it take using all the matter within the Hubble radius? That is the knowable universe. Maybe more universe than that. That's the knowable universe. 2.5 × 10⁻³⁸ years. What's the chance it happened in the 20 billion years since the Big Bang? 1 × 10⁸. Now, I did those calculations myself. I'm not a biologist. I can move figures around a little bit. One might be suspicious of that. A similar result, however, was obtained by Sir Fred Hoyle and Chandra Wickramasinghe in their calculations. They have brought a book out this fall. It's already appeared in England. It has not shown up here in this country yet. It's to come out this month, though, called Space Travelers, the Bringers of Life. They felt that you could not get life formed with any likelihood on this planet, that the likelihood that it would happen anywhere in the universe is very small. I get the impression, I have only a newspaper article about it, that they are deciding to have it, unlikely as it is, formed somewhere in the universe and brought here. Well, that calculation shows us at least one thing, that if life formed, there must be almost an infinity of ways for life to form, if it formed naturally, because there hasn't been anything like the time to try out any, even a minute, hardly a minuscule fraction of the possibilities. Sagan, then, to maintain his view that there is no God, has only time and chance, working within the scope of the physical laws, to develop the requisite order. Now, we can, of course, beg the question. We can say, life exists now, therefore it must have come into existence by natural processes. But notice, that does beg the question of whether there's a supernatural. The Christian view is that God, whom we can represent very sloppily as a mind analogous to man's but way beyond it, produced this order. God, a mind like ours but way beyond it, produced this order. Now, here's what can be said for the status of the two positions. Sagan has a model which cannot be demonstrated to work by computer modeling. We cannot produce the requisite levels of order by random processes, computer model. Christians have a view that can be shown to work. We know that a human mind can produce order. Now, it's possible that you are wondering about your roommate on this point, but we do know that human minds can produce order. And so we're basically saying the human mind is an analog to God's mind, just as we can produce order, so God produced order, just as a random process does not seem to be able to produce the kind of order needed with the available material, with the available time, so that is a model which has not been shown by any analog to work. Well, we've looked over, I think, two rather central matters related to Sagan's cosmos. If there's a God, something is drastically wrong with this presentation. And I think there's quite substantial evidence that there's a God. At this point, however, one might argue, well, we've got two alternatives, and probably some others as well. We've got an eternal universe with no God. We've got an eternal God with a created universe. They're both based on inferences. Take your pick. Take your chances. Some prefer one, some prefer the other, but we're both making inferences, and we can never know what the right result is. Well, I think Christians may respond that if we're right, you will at the latest find out when you die. But that would be a bad time to wait and find out. Christians, however, claim that one can move beyond inference to a much stronger position than that on the basis of reasonable procedures. Let's take an illustration to try and picture this. There are many people today that believe there is intelligent life in the universe. There are many people who believe that other than man, there isn't any intelligent life in the universe, and some wonder about him. You have UFO groups, and you have scientific groups who believe that there are extraterrestrial intelligences, and both of those are trying to communicate with extraterrestrial intelligences. Now, that whole question of whether there are extraterrestrial intelligences or not would be confirmed by a validated communication with those extraterrestrial intelligences. We got a message we could show was from out there somewhere. Then I think it would solve the question beyond inference that we have an extraterrestrial intelligence. Well, Christians claim that the Bible is a communication of the most intelligent extraterrestrial intelligence that exists, namely God Himself, and that it has the solutions for the basic problems faced by mankind. It has the solutions for the very things that are worrying Carl Sagan in his book Cosmos. What is man? Where is he going? What's going to happen to this planet? What is life all about? Those sorts of things. Now, of course, the claim itself doesn't prove anything, any more than my telling you that I was a UFO contactee and I'd been taken to Venus, which, by the way, I have not. However, there are, I believe, several lines of evidence that indicate that the Bible is not merely a vast hoax perpetrated by some ancient writers, which has been superstitiously believed all these many years. I would suggest three lines of validation for this. There are other lines. These, I think, will take me all the time I've got for the rest of this evening. However, I hope that won't be too long. I'm sure you do too. First of all, historical validation. The Bible pictures some rather striking interventions that have occurred in history as a result of God communicating with mankind. I picked two of these particularly because they are the basic two, if you like, that are involved in the Bible. To Moses and the resultant formation of the Israeli nation and the resultant giving of the law, which is formed certainly the basis of the Old Testament, and the appearance of Jesus on the scene about 2,000 years ago, his formation of the church, and his proclamation of the materials which he taught, which we call the gospel, which formed the basis of the New Testament. Now, if you've had any work, in Old or New Testament, in religion course anywhere, you're probably aware that there are a great many people who believe that these events did not really happen as presented, anything of that variety. And of course, being historical statements, there's no way we can go back and look. Time machines work extremely well in science fiction, but seem to have a logical flaw at them, at their center, if you like, that prohibits their actually working in reality. That flaw has to do with the conservation of matter and the identity of entities. Let me give you a quick example. Suppose I've invented a time machine. I'm not at all adventurous, but I want to make a killing. So I spend all my life savings and the life savings of 5 or 10 other people and I buy a gold brick about this big. And I set it on the table in front of me and I get the time machine. I go back a second. And since I set the thing on there and had to adjust all the controls, the brick is still there when I get out. I pick the brick up, put it in the machine. I move the control back another second and get out. The brick's still there. Put it in the machine. Move it back another second, get out, put the brick on. Get another one. Pretty soon I got the thing filled with bricks. Bring it back to the present, put them in the bank. that in itself, a violation, I think, of the identity of things, rather suggests that there is a philosophical and logical flaw in the whole idea of time travel. Well, we cannot therefore go back in time to examine to see whether these things actually occurred, but it's very interesting to see the rather wild conjecture that is necessary to explain away these events. Here we have a nation whose whole existence is based upon an event of being brought out of bondage from Egypt, crossing the Red Sea, receiving the law at Sinai, things of that variety. They've got the law, they've got the history, etc. And to explain that away those who hold that there is no miraculous have been forced to take the documents and say, this was written 1,000 years after the time claim, and this was written 1,100 years after, and this was written 1,200 years after, and they have had to divide up the books into all of these very, very complicated schemes. The same sort of thing that literateurs were doing with Homer and with Beowulf and with Shakespeare and all of those other things in the last century. And yet, in Old Testament work and New Testament work alone, are those theories still in the air? Because otherwise it's hard to explain away the historicity of those events. Those things themselves, I think, are two of the striking examples where an intervention of God really has changed the course of history. And to avoid it, one has to begin to do very, very funny things with the evidence. I have written a little paper on this general subject related to the New Testament, which friends were kind enough to bring with them. I didn't know they were going to bring them tonight, called The Biblical Narratives of Easter Week, Are They Trustworthy? If you have a look at that, notice a rather interesting feature. What you really have is the explanation that the resurrection did not occur is totally an outworking of the idea that there is no miraculous. It is not a fair dealing with the documents to see whether or not something of that sort might not indeed have happened. That's the area I would call historical validation. And basically point out here that real changes have taken place in history for which only rather trivial causes can be assigned when one has no miraculous, and which a great deal of juggling has to be done with the documents. A great deal of juggling has to be done with the nature of the groups that preserve these documents in order to explain them away. The second one is a little bit more direct, and it's what we might call prophetic validation. In the area of science, one of the strengths of a theory is its ability to predict how things not yet observed ought to be, if indeed the theory is correct. Well, the Bible claims that its author is the one who controls history and puts forth as an evidence of this that he in fact can tell you about events long in advance of their occurrence. I have about 7 examples here I want to run through quickly for you. If you have some questions, I will look at a couple of them in some detail in a question period. In Jeremiah chapter 51, verses 42 and 43, we are told of the great city of Babylon, which was the capital of the world at his time, that it would not only be destroyed, no great statement, that has happened to nearly every city that has existed for more than a few hundred years, but that it would be deserted, it would become a desert. The area remained, though it was damaged in the time that the Persians took over, the area remained a rather populous area for centuries until finally the channel of the Euphrates River changed and Babylon was left high and dry 20 miles from the new river channel and is now a desert area. In the book of Ezekiel, chapter 30, verse 13, a statement in the midst of a series of prophecies regarding Egypt is a very strange one. We are told that the idols of the city of Memphis will disappear. Now, when we go into Egypt today, we can find plenty of idols in most of the ancient cities of Egypt. But in Memphis, out of the thousands and thousands of idols that stood there, 2 can be found today. And the reason is, historically, that the Muslims built their capital city just a few miles away at Cairo, and they used Memphis as a quarry for the stone for their new place. So they destroyed the idols, cut them up so that they were not recognizable into stone blocks, and used those blocks to build the city. In Ezekiel chapter 26, verses 4 and 12, we're not only told that the city of Tyre will be destroyed in an invasion at a time following Ezekiel's time, but we are told that the dust of the city would be scraped up and thrown into the sea. Debris of the city, even its very dust, would be scraped up and thrown into the sea. When Nebuchadnezzar took Tyre, some years after Ezekiel's time, he knocked the city down, left it there. No big deal. Nothing happened in that direction at all. But 300 years later, when Alexander came through the area, the Tyrians had moved off to an island about a mile off the shore, near the Mediterranean, and so he asked them if he could come into the city to worship. And want him to come into the city to worship, they figured he'd pillage a place. They said, there's a remains of a temple out there, a worship out there. Alexander didn't like that. And he decided, as an example, he would take care of the Tyrians. But he found that it was rather difficult with a navy to do much, even with a navy, to do much against a offshore island like that. So he finally decided he was going to have to build a causeway. And so he took the rubble from the old on-land city of Tyre, dumped it into the waters there, dumped dirt, hauled a lot of other things until he made a substantial causeway that went over to the island city of Tyre, and there he took the city. Indeed, the very dust of the city, the rubble of the city, was moved over to the sea, as predicted here. A more striking one, those three involve cities, although all of those are major cities in antiquity. A more striking one involves a rather general picture of Israel's future from the time that the prophecy was made by Hosea, Hosea chapter 3, verses 4 and 5. Hosea has been told by God that his marriage is going to be a picture of the relationship between God and the nation Israel. He marries a woman who becomes unfaithful to him, just as the Israelites were unfaithful to God. The woman goes off and has children by various people, and they are named in various ways that are predictive of things that are going to happen to Israel. And then in Hosea chapter 3, verses 4 and 5, Hosea buys back his wife who had run away from him, who had gotten reduced to slavery, had been sold in the slave market. He buys her back, and he is told that she is to come home with him, but there to be no marital relations between them for a long time, but then after that time, they will be back together as husband and wife. And then this prediction is given. The sons of Israel, for many days, will be without king and without government official, without sacrifice, without pillar, without ephod, and without teraphim. They're going to be without their king, who is a crucial part of the Old Testament arrangement, that the king was the one appointed by God to protect the Israelites. They were going to be even without a government official. They weren't even going to have a government for a long period of time. They were going to be without sacrifice, a central feature of the whole Mosaic religion. They were going to be without pillars, and the pillars were involved both in their own worship and in idolatrous worship they had trouble with. They were going to be without ephod, that was a garment worn by the high priest, and yet they were going to be without idols, the teraphim is a word for idols. That is, there was going to be a long period in Israel's history when they would have no monarchy, in fact, no government. They would have no Sinai religion, but they wouldn't be idolaters either. That has been very, very strikingly fulfilled in the history of Israel from about 70 AD till this very time. From 70 AD until 1948, the Israelites were not only without a king, they had no government official. Although they were, a whole sole arrangement of the Old Testament was that they should worship by sacrificial means, they have not carried on sacrifice since the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. And they still do not. We're told further on in prophecy that this will change as the end approaches. They will return to their God and to David, their king. Another example relates to the time of the Messiah's coming. We're told in Genesis chapter 49:10 that the scepter, the symbol of rule, will not depart from Judah until the one comes to whom it belongs. As we look through the history of Israel, we see that there is a period, starting at 587 BC, in which there is no king over Israel for quite a long time, no king over Judah for quite a long time, down to the time of the Maccabees. But in the time of the Maccabees, there were kings over Judah again. And then, in the New Testament period, Herod the Great is king over Judah, and his grandson, Herod Agrippa I, is king over Judah. But from that day till this, there has been no king over Judah. The passage would seem to indicate that the Messiah had come by or before the death of Herod Agrippa I, 44 A.D. In Daniel chapter 9, verses 24 through 27, a much more specific chronological prophecy is given, which appears to have been involved in the Jewish revolt against Rome, 66 to 70 A.D. In this prophecy, we are told that from the going forth of a commandment to rebuild the city of Jerusalem until the time of the coming of Messiah the Prince, there would be a period of 69 weeks, they are called. They appear to be referring to the sabbatical cycle week, to what's called week in the Intertestament period, a period of 7 years that had been running throughout antiquity in which the Jews were supposed to allow their land to lie fallow for 1 year out of every seven. By calculating from the most reasonable suggestion for the command to rebuild Jerusalem, that is the command given by Persian King Artaxerxes I, that allowed Nehemiah to go back and rebuild the fortifications that made the site of Jerusalem no longer a village, but a city, that occurred in 445 or 444 BC, we find out that falls in the middle of one of these sabbatical cycles, as you would expect. They take up all the time, running every 7 years. And if we count that one, as the Jews normally would for time counting, the first of these sabbatical cycles, it turns out then that the 69th one is the years 28 through 35 A.D. And the statement is that the Messiah would come somewhere in the period 28 through 35 A.D. It goes on to say that he would be cut off and have nothing. Rather strikingly, the most famous claimant for the Messiahship in the history of the nation of Israel, Jesus of Nazareth, appeared and carried out his ministry exactly in that 7 year period, and he was cut off. Isaiah 49:6 tells us that the coming Messiah would be a light to the Gentiles, and it is rather striking that indeed the religion of Israel, which remained within one race for centuries from the time of Moses, began finally in a striking way to move out to all the other nations as a result of the ministry of this Jesus of Nazareth in the first century A.D. In Isaiah chapter 11, verses 11 and following, we are told that Israel will one day be regathered from all the nations, and it names a whole sequence of nations from which it will be regathered. It's interesting that in our own generation, those very areas that are explicitly named have been nearly depopulated of Jews as a result of reaction to the Holocaust and reaction to problems with resurgent Islam. We're also told that they will go back and become a unified nation on their own land, which indeed has already happened as well. The passage goes on to mention other things which are related to the end and suggest that perhaps the end may not be as far away as the collapse of this particular cosmos that we are in. Those would be examples of specific predictions made in Scripture centuries in advance of their occurrence, which have indeed come true in a striking way. They are not trivial examples. They are examples that deal with major movements of people and of armies. There's a personal validation as well, and that is this. The Bible's message, when believed and made a part of one's life, is a life-transforming message. The number of people who have had their whole life turned around is a very, very striking thing in Christian circles. I do not know of any other religion that has something comparable to that. As you can see, when you go into a Christian bookstore and look at the hundreds and hundreds of personal transformation testimony books that exist in such bookstores, I certainly guarantee you that nothing has happened in secular humanism that can match it. Challenge was once made to a rather famous Christian evangelist, Harry Ironside, in the 20s of this century. A fellow came up to him when he was giving a street meeting, handed him a card. He was a rather outstanding socialist leader in San Francisco at that time, and he had written on the card, meet me at one of the local halls, he named it, tomorrow, and we will have a debate about the relative merits of socialism and Christianity. Ironside read the note, and he said, I will be glad to make arrangements to debate with you at that time, but in order that we give some indication if there's anything worth debating about, I would like you to bring with you, one man and one woman. The one man, I would like to be someone who has been totally overpowered at an earlier time in his life by some habit that he could not kick. Whether it be alcohol, whether it be drugs, whether it be something of that sort, bring one. And bring a woman who had been involved as a professional prostitute for many, many years. And as a result of your preaching, of your message, this person had been turned away from that, that she saw that socialism was what she needed to get her life together. And she left that. And that this one fellow, by the power of socialism, was able to turn away from his addiction to drugs or his addiction to drink. Bring them. And I'll bring, he said, 50 of each. And I'll be able to get them from right here in San Francisco, he said. That, I think, is a very short illustration of the life-transforming power of the biblical message. It's something that you can see in people you know. It's hard to believe when you read books about it, because you don't know whether the guys are writing fiction or not. You've got to see it in somebody. But it is something very powerful. You can see it in yourself. All you need to do is be willing to trust the one who has sent the message. Well, what can we say in conclusion? I think we can draw our conclusion from a statement of Sagan on page 333 of his work. Sagan sees two cardinal rules of science. The first, he says, is for science, there are no sacred truths. All assumptions must be critically examined. And the second one is, whatever is inconsistent with the facts must be discarded or revised. Strangely enough, the Bible agrees with both of those statements, and they can both be found in one place, 1 Thessalonians 5:21. Test everything, hold fast to that which is good. Sagan also says on the same page, we must understand the cosmos as it is, and not confuse how it is with how we wish it to be. May we all follow this excellent advice. I would be glad to try and entertain some questions. Let me warn you in advance. I may have to say, I don't know. Yes, sir, right here.
I think God taking the cosmos has been a tremendous service to the public, where he has been able to explain to thousands of people what science is, what science can do, and what science cannot do. The evidence of the cosmos has been extremely useful, very important to the public, has been overwhelming, and we owe Carl Sagan a gratitude of thanks. Second, I would like to just remark on two very key and important subjects that our speaker spoke about today. One is about the first and very important notion about what the cosmos is all. Cosmos is all there is, apparently, is what the notion has been. That statement is by definition correct, because scientists have said all the time that everything that we know of the rational is what we define as the cosmos. If we find anything more, that is incorporated in the meaning of cosmos. So therefore, it is just a philosophical definition, and there is no ambiguity whatsoever. The second subject has to do with the oscillating universe that we heard that Carl Sagan preferred. Scientists have never said so far that we know what the origin of the universe and what the cosmological model of the universe is. Scientists have been only able to devise theoretical explanations for the universe, one of which is the oscillating universe. It will very well be that the universe will turn out to be an oscillating universe, and when we have more evidence and more information and more observations, that will become clear. Let me remind you that many things that we thought were totally unexplainable, and we call them miracles, given the course of history and the knowledge that our species has been able to accumulate, we have been able to explain and understand a fantastic number of so-called miracles by natural processes. Science has done a fantastic amount of progress, and it's continuing. And lastly, about life. Our speaker very courageously described to us the probability that it is so hard to form all these very intricate, very difficult combinations of particles, complex ones, which we call life, because the probabilities are low. But don't forget, by the very nature of probability, we mean a distribution. A distribution. It could happen very quickly. That is possible.
Okay, I have two responses to Dr. Tertian. he says, of course, that many miracles have been explained. I am not aware of any of the miracles of either the Old or New Testament that we can now show to be just a simple natural process which the ancients, because of their lack of science knowledge, misunderstood. In spite of their rather poor knowledge of science, they managed just to hit upon the things that we cannot duplicate scientifically today. So I think there would be some problem in that direction. The other point is, if Sagan's first statement in his book is a definition, he has certainly misled many, many people. I have no objection to his statement as a definition, if cosmos is intended to include God and all of the other things which he has made. I do not think, however, that is a fair interpretation of how he develops his material later on, where he certainly speaks of the cosmos as something that we can save a step by saying the cosmos has always existed, rather than that God has always existed. Further questions? Yes, sir.
In relation to what the professor said, didn't Dr. Sagan mention the dichotomy between chaos and cosmos, chaos being disorder and cosmos being order? So therefore, he made it a definition out of the term cosmos. Not necessarily saying anything about a region of space. Like when you mentioned limits, I don't think that was really appropriate. I don't think he means cosmos as meaning a region of space surrounded by a roadblock where you cannot go over or see over. He didn't make anything about order. And I also like to say that in this TV series, the name of the series title was Cosmos, a Personal Voyage. Now, I think what he was doing in the series perhaps was he was surveying what we know already about the universe, and then perhaps speculating beyond in his own, I think, as like over the personal voyage. And I'd also like to mention that the idea of, when he mentions like God, I'll save a step. If you postulate God, then usually most Christians will say that God is a very complex, very, you said, way beyond the human mind, is a very complex entity, if you can call an entity. Therefore, if you describe God in that fashion, then can't you consider God as being more complex than the universe itself? So if you explain the universe by God, you're really postulating a more complex object. You explain a less complex object, and therefore you're introducing infinite regress. And,
Excuse me. Go ahead.
I don't understand what people say that if you can't see beyond, as an analogy, if you're on a roadside, you cannot see beyond a certain bend in the road.
then why assume something's there? If you want to believe a low voice coming towards you around the bend of the road, you can't tell. Why not just, for now, assume that there's nothing there until you can prove something is there beyond what you can actually sense, you know, your senses pick up? Well, why assume that there's a Rolls Royce? You may believe it's a Rolls Royce, and Mohammedans may believe there's a Corvette, and the Buddhists may believe a Chevrolet.
I rather doubt that Sagan, in his treatment as a whole, is using cosmos equals order versus chaos equals disorder, though he certainly does bring that up in his discussion of certain of the ancient views regarding creation. Reason why perhaps would suggest that is if he says that, one would be saying order is all that is, whereas I think Sagan would feel there is perhaps some disorder here and there. In fact, he feels he is trying to fight the forces of disorder in complaining against mysticism. I have no question in my mind that Sagan's cosmos is a personal voyage, yet what I feel is misleading about it is the average person who watches it has no idea what is personal voyage beyond the evidence and what is an objective voyage in the evidence. And so one is being evangelized beyond the evidence, if you like, by his very presentation. The whole matter of whether God is more complicated than the universe, I'm inclined to think, yes, God is more complicated than the universe. The reason I believe that he exists is I don't think the universe gives evidence that it explains itself. And as I pointed out, I think there is excellent evidence that God has in fact communicated. And so we're dealing with a question of not Occam's razor choose the simplest model, but the other side of Occam's razor, the simplest model that fits the data. So that would be the direction I would be going on that particular question. Yes, sir, back here in the green. Probably so. We probably need about something like 61st years, perhaps, to make. Now, with only a small amount of specification, you run beyond any reasonable possibility that they've happened yet. Given enough time, a statement that a particular city is going to be destroyed is pretty well bound to come true. But when you begin to add details to it and you name the city, then the amount of time that that's even likely to happen begins to spread out to enormous amounts. Yes. Now, we do need to say something here. When we discuss time and chance in this way, we're making certain epistemological assumptions even. We're assuming that certain things, that the universe is a certain way, which it might not very well be. It is very easy, with assumptions of time and chance, to go way beyond anything we've observed. For instance, in your whole study of kinetic theory, it is in principle possible that when you take a pan of water and set it on a stove and turn the stove on, that the random motion of molecules will flip out one molecule with nearly all the energy and leave a pile of ice in the pan. But when you do a calculation on that, you find out that that is far less likely would occur far more rarely than the time you have had or the amount of material you have had to actually build the whole kinetic theory of gases on. In other words, you've run way beyond the observational support for the very assumption of randomness. It seems to me that they are specific enough that the chances of even three or four of these things having happened is minuscule, even if you assume that all the other Bible statements about predictions were wrong. And in fact, I don't know of examples where the Bible has made predictions that have not panned out, though it must be admitted that the Bible makes predictions about the very end of the age, and I don't know exactly how to say we'll wait till we see whether there is one or not. If there is one, that will end the experiment rather quickly, obviously. If you have to wait 2 million more years, you may begin to suspect that there isn't one. But it's hard to know methodologically where to draw the line at that point. Yes, sir, here in the Czech shirt.
Pointed out accurately some shortcomings in Dr. Sagan's treatment. And I think, similar to those, you have several scientific shortcomings in your presentation that you've given us tonight. Dr. Terzian talked about a couple of those, and there's just one that I would like to mention specifically because it has to do with knowledge which is not yet general in the public, unfortunately, and that is on chemical evolution and the origin of complicated systems from simple ones. Now, we do have some more information on how such things can take place. There are two real problems with the simple probabilistic explanations, which you mentioned, which do indeed indicate a vanishingly small probability for something like a 100 amino acid protein to form. One of those is that out of all of the amazing numbers of combinations of these proteins that you can make, an extremely large number as well, do have catalytic activity, for example, if you're talking about an enzyme, which are similar. The rates will differ, but there's strong evidence that having formed by just a random process one of this very large subclass of molecules which has the right kind of function, you then can make a system in which a certain property can be refined, and it's refined through interactions between molecules which will allow the protein to become slightly more efficient through time and its carrying out of its activities. The second problem is that it's not even a random process because it is a directed process. Whenever you have a thermodynamic process in which molecules are interacting, you tend to go towards systems which are most stable or most favorable. And there's strong indication from recent work that such processes as the condensation of amino acids on clays of various types through freezing and drying cycles can produce systems of high order because under drying conditions, when a lot of energy is pumped into the system, systems of high order will form because of alignments with crystalline patterns on the clays themselves. And in relation to that specifically, I'd just like to mention that Dr. David White of University of Santa Clara has published some information recently in which he has in the laboratory actually made systems of up to tens of nucleic acids which are self-replicating and make more and more complex systems with time, published in the Journal of Molecular Biology in the past couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, now I am familiar with most of those things, though not in the journals, in more popular literature. I'm aware of the clay templates being used for the whole matter of production of longer chains. And I had heard that some types of replicating things were formed, and I'd seen some diagrams of them somewhere. No, nothing high powered, either Science Magazine or Science News. my treatment here was not so much the question of forming chain molecules, because notice I gave all the benefit in that area. I had you already with nothing but 100-link chains, and the fastest kind of reactions it could go. My whole question was the formation of meaningful information by random processes, and suggested that even under these ideal conditions, running through the possibilities in order to construct a information system ran beyond the kinds of time and such that you have available. So I really was not going in that area at all.
Right. Just in a very brief response to that, my statement really is that out of, say, 10 to the 31 molecules, perhaps 10 to the 28 or so, might have what we would construe at this point to be information, because the information is just the expression of the fact that they had a certain chemical activity which interacted in a synergistic and positive way with the chemical activity of other molecules, and therefore it became locked into the system. My real point is that there's such a huge number of possible outcomes for that the real possibility of getting a good system is much higher than one would think.
Yeah, I would be interested to see some mathematical justification for that by analog calculations on a computer, by an attempt to actually randomly generate a system like that. That's what I have in mind, see. I've not seen anything on that. I'll have to wait until it comes around. Let me ask this fellow in the brown shirt here.
I have not a question, but a statement, and that is that as a scientist myself, and on behalf of the many eminent Jewish scientists here at Columbia, I find your identification of the Nazi Holocaust with scientific method both offensive and unwarranted.
It was not an identification of the scientific method with it. It was a model, a example of how things have been done misusing the name of science. Just as I said that what was done to the killing of Hypatia was a misuse of the name of Christianity. I did not claim it was a proper use of science. I did not claim that is what scientists are necessarily doing, although there are some serious problems with what many German scientists did do in Hitler's Holocaust.
In that particular instance, to convince themselves that it was anything but racism, and certainly not science.
I have no problem with that. No problem with that at all. Hitler claimed it to be science.
That was not in the name of science, but something territory polygenics, which does not at all have anything to do with the killing of Jews. Anything anti-Semitism is much more distinctly related to religion than to science.
I'm sure it has religious connections as well, though it does not have support from the biblical material. I'd be glad to follow that up further if you'd like. Yes. Okay.
Let's. Anyway, I will add something else.
Yes, go ahead.
Let me paraphrase something that someone has tried to say before now, mainly that prophecies are something very exciting. I would love to be able to read prophecies out of the Bible. The problem is whether prophecies can be made into an exact science, excuse the term, reading into the Bible, or whether it's just a matter of getting after the fact. I mean, the proper way of getting the science is to compute things, and you say, this is the prediction, and then you go and experiment. It seems to me the overwhelming probability is that we will never find in the Bible a prophecy which we then can test. There has been no example, and I don't know if anybody can now point out to a prophecy which will, let's say, happen in the next 10 years. All the examples that you cite are examples which, after the fact, you go back and read into the text.
Well, there's certain. There certainly were many evangelical Christians who in the 19th century pointed out that the biblical material points to the return of Israel to their own land, and who were very Zionist because of that. And a story which may be apocryphal, I'm not sure about this, on the point, is that one such person was rather distressed when Herzl was ready to take Uganda as the land of that the Jews would be allowed to go back to instead of Israel. But indeed, what happened is they did go back to the land of Israel. So there is one which has been known and discussed. J.H. Kellogg, I think, his work on the Jews, written in the 1850s, is a very striking example of that type of material. It's called The Jews, Prediction and Fulfillment.
Science has not been changed as a religion, it's with dogmatism and literalism. I don't think that as scientists we rule out religion, we just rule out the idea that religion should impose truths on science. And that is precisely what happened in the case of Luther, ruling that Copernicus was wrong. That's precisely what happened in the case of the Church ruling that Galileo was wrong. Science, the system which is consistent by itself, and it is not reasonable to impose on it outside or external criteria of truth.
I think it's fair to say that some things that were done to Galileo were imposing upon Galileo. I don't think any question about that. It's very difficult to see that the remark made by Luther was imposing anything on Copernicus. He was disagreeing with Copernicus, which people have a perfect right to do, and which they will be right sometimes and wrong sometimes.
The point is that dogmatism refuses to even consider the possibility that one might be wrong. And that's what we have there.
Well, I certainly don't refuse to accept the possibility I might be wrong on things. Now, there are certainly Christians who have, but I've never run into a Christian who didn't have doubts occasionally. And doubts are considering the possibility that you might be wrong. Now, Christianity does believe that we actually have a communication from the one that put the whole universe together. So naturally, we're not happy when somebody suggests that the universe always existed. We feel we've got evidence that supports our position, so we disagree with the other position, just like a person who feels that someone else is misusing the data. We feel that persons who deny the existence of God haven't looked at certain crucial data. Yes, sir.
But Galileo was brought before a position which is not, you cannot call a scientific or a body which is concerned with perhaps the trouble, maybe we're going to lose our Aristotelian Christian synthesis. I thought they were more concerned with showing him the racks and the basement and the different torture chambers and saying, okay, here's your choice. Would you rather can't or have this? And Galileo decided on this. And I really don't see why you consider that to be a rational. Disagreement. I think that's coercion.
Yeah, I agree it's coercion. Okay. Although you have jazzed it up a little bit. The Inquisition that existed where Galileo was at his time was not the Spanish Inquisition. But two problems there. One would be, I think, that the Bible does not teach coercion of that variety. So the particular people there were not literalists on the point. They were persons who had to use some rather fancy footwork to justify that particular activity. The second question I would raise is that those particular groups were not, according to my understanding of the biblical material, Christian by the biblical definition. Now, you may feel that's running away from things, but that is rather similar to the whole thing brought up here about saying these guys who were involved in what was going on in the Holocaust were not scientists by your definition. And I agree with that. There were certainly people involved in it who considered themselves scientists.
What is regarded as science and what is clearly racism. And if you are trying to tell me that the Holocaust is not a case of blatant racism,
I'm not trying to say that it wasn't a case of blatant racism. I was trying to say that they felt themselves to be in the right scientifically in what they were doing. And they felt that on the basis of Darwinian models, one would not be surprised that some branches of the human race might be more advanced than other branches were, and then drew a unwarranted conclusion that you could mishandle people who are less intelligent than you.
I could call myself a Christian and yet go around preaching that Jesus Christ was a thing, and I would not be regarded by most people as a proper Christian.
Hold it a moment. There are people who are teaching in theological seminaries who have said Jesus Christ was a fake, and for some unbeknownst reason their denominations have not gotten rid of them. I don't regard them as Christians, but they're there.
I'm saying there is a consensus of opinion between the mass of people who call themselves Christians as to what a Christian is.
There is not a consensus of opinion between the mass of people who call themselves Christians as to what a Christian is.
But in my experience, scientists have a consensus of opinion about how a scientist goes about his job, and that does not include the murder of 6 million people. That's all I'm trying to say.
Well, I think it's fair to say that that Christians, if they have any consensus on the matter, do not favor murdering Hypatia or other people of that variety. So you're applying, you're not applying it. Sagan rather strongly points that way, however, implying that that is Christianity versus science is, I think, mistaken there.
When the Christian crusaders entered Jerusalem, they systematically massacred all the Jewish and Muslim inhabitants with the consent of Rome. And that never happened when any other religion,
never mind secular humanism,
that
in Jerusalem. Well, basically, again, we come back.
The record of religion as regards messages and so on is infinitely worse than that of science.
My argument here would not be with science as a method. I'm in favor of science as a method. As I think I pointed out somewhere back up early in the court in the discussion, my argument basically would be that Sagan is in fact not operating as a scientist in a great deal of his book here. He is operating as a secular humanist. And certainly if one is going to identify the Roman Catholic Church with me as a Christian, I'm Catholic, then I feel that I can lump together the atheists and charge upon those who are atheists what the communists have been doing, and they certainly have at least put in a shade, or at least come in the same ballpark with the activities of the others. Yes, and I think we're going to have to stop with this, but I'll be glad to try and talk with anybody personally, okay?
The quotation from Karl Marx, which goes, the current definition of trading is the most of the trading word, which translates approximately into, they cannot represent themselves, they must be represented. And as far as I know from my readings of Carl Sagan, I have never seen him state that he is a secular humanist and that this is his religion and so on. And as far as I can tell, he's putting words into his mouth and interpreting what he says and what he does in a very particular way which suits your purpose. Why don't you ask Carl Sagan himself what he thinks about this?
Okay. No problem with that. Be glad to do that. What I have done here, basically, is look at the points he deals with in the book that line up, that are mentioned in the Humanist Manifesto, which is what we would take, I think, to be the definition of secular humanism, and find he agrees with them on the points where I can see him make any statement along the matter. See, I don't define a secular humanist as a person who belongs to the American Humanist Association, because in today's religious world, many Unitarians are atheists. Many Methodists are Unitarians. There are even some Jews for Jesus. You have to find out what a person says and take that as a statement of what his theological position is, whether he belongs to a particular group or not.
This has been a presentation of IBRI, the Interdisciplinary Biblical Research Institute. IBRI is a group of like-minded Christians who see a desperate need for men and women who are persuaded of the complete reliability of the Bible to get training both in biblical studies and some other academic discipline, and to use this training both to help other Christians deal with many areas where non-Christian teaching is so dominant today, and also to remove many stumbling blocks that have kept others from the gospel. Such help is given through a continuing series of seminars, through IBRI's free catalog of literature and cassettes, and through lectures and slide talks that can be given by members of IBRI at your location. For more information or a free copy of our catalog, please write to IBRI, Post Office Box 145, Hatfield, Pennsylvania, zip code 19440.